You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hello, hello, hello. You know, I started this podcast because I love podcasts, but I also think it is always going to be a feature of my life and personality, or maybe my calling outside of music, to somehow manifest and explore this constant curiosity and share it with others. I'm always chasing after that paradigm-shifting thoughts, the facts, the tidbits, the experiences of other people, the bar conversations, the backstage conversations, just hoping for those aha moments, you know, like what really kind of changes the way that you think about the world. I think that that is really just a fantastic journey to be on and a great way to view the world. So this is the first episode of a little offshoot to the regular format of the podcast. It's called The Friday Files. It's going to be me talking about whatever I want with whomever I want. Get at me, tom@futurefriday.net, with any notes or ideas or bullshit, and I will reply. We have some compilation episodes coming up where they're just going to be topic-based. We have some timed ones that are going to be checking in every so often and compiling them at the end, like some of the Serialized podcast that I really like. I'm super stoked. So just get at me, tom@futurefriday.net, and I'll get back to you. If you haven't yet, and you are in the tri-state mid-Atlantic region, of which you have a high statistical probability of being if you're listening to this podcast and live in the United States, rush on over to Instagram and check out Little Fern Workshop. Little Fern Workshop is a new company started by our very own Eric Keen and his wonderful wife, Georgia. They have vintage, restored, and handcrafted items and furniture out of South Philly. They find some really cool shit all over the area. They fix it up, restore it, and sell it. They have some really cool shit up there. So you can search hashtag Ferns in Stock to see what they've got and give them a follow. Again, that's Little Fern Workshop on Instagram. You can search hashtag Ferns in Stock. I have one more favor to ask you guys. It would be great if you could rate and subscribe to the podcast. Better yet, it would be fantastic if you told somebody about it that you think would enjoy it. I do not like hammering social media. I find it tedious. It's unattractive. It's one of the reasons why sometimes the episodes don't come out in a timely fashion, because I just stare at the list of posts to make and think, I hate this, even though it's not that labor intensive. Honestly, I'd really like to pop in to everybody once in a while via email with some updates of the episodes that have come out and some things that are going on in the world of myself, Future Friday, the band, all that shit. I find that to be much more attractive of an endeavor. Turns out the email sign-up list on futurefriday.net has been broken, but it should be fixed by the time this comes out, hopefully. But now, without further ado, one of the greatest people on Earth and my fellow cosmic comrade, Joe Godino.
Go.
I'm just going to start it right now. Ready? Joey, thank you so much for joining me for the first ever iteration of Friday Files. I'm so excited to have this goofy, well, it doesn't even have to be goofy, but like
yeah,
a new outlet
awesome.
To just
this
do fun stuff.
This has been really cool. I was like, I spent like a few hours like researching, like as if I was writing like a book report. Like I forgot what that feels like. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, it's so fun. I even had myself like getting, remember you have to like state your mission or purpose in the first paragraph and then roll it over. And,
yeah, totally.
Yeah, it was fun to revisit that. Yeah. Also, funny thing of note, this morning when we were talking in the band group text message chat about all of our missing microphones.
Oh,
guess what,
bad
guess
boy.
What right here.
I had two.
One of the missing microphones. I searched my whole house. And
yeah,
really,
Greg
was
like,
right
where are all
face?
Our microphones? I was like, I don't have any of those. Why would I have those? And then there's two in the office. I was like, oh, shit. Never mind.
Yeah, I had a couple of mine are missing. I don't know where they are. I'm going to blame Dave March because it's easy because he's in England.
Yeah,
and he can't defend
they're gone
himself.
Now. England's
they're gone
that much further away these days.
It really is. We can't go there. All right, yeah. So the format, basically, we're kind of jacking the what I've seen a lot of podcasts do, like My Favorite Murder and stuff like that. I guess we're just going to retell and comment on some stories that we find interesting. And for you and I, it happens to breach into the UFO territory. So for the first ever Friday File ever in history,
I'm going to tell the story of the aerial school phenomenon. It was an event that took place in Zimbabwe at a like primary school in 1994, where a bunch of little kids, basically, they saw some crafts land with beings, actual beings that came out of them and everything. It's a pretty wild story. And I think it's a story that's pretty commonly known throughout people that like research this type of stuff, like UFOs and just whatever phenomenon. But I was surprised to find, with that being said, that there's not like a ton of information about it. Like certain people do stories on it, and I was able to find some interviews and stuff. But as a whole, for as popular as it seems within this world, there wasn't like a ton of stuff. So it was actually cool because I was able to like dig a little bit. And when I found something like an interview or a more recent thing, it was like that much more gratifying because it was like, oh, it was just hard to find really. So.
Yeah. Hell yeah. When you said that you were going to do this one, I purposefully didn't. I was debating whether or not I was going to do a refresher and reread about it or maybe watch a couple YouTube videos, and I decided not to. I think it'd be a lot more
fun. Yeah, so the first time I heard about it, and I'll dive into it real quick, but the first time I heard about it was in a book by Richard Dolan that you suggested I read, Aliens or UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. It's an awesome book because it's really down to earth. You don't have to be head in the clouds researcher of this stuff to like really grasp it. It's really like down to earth.
Totally. And it's really a void of a lot of the things that you find when people research these phenomena, and in this like UFO research culture where there's so much anecdotal evidence but also just so much like wading through the ideas of misinformation or disinformation and just like all the politics that people have within their own UFO bullshit. The dude's just like a serious historian. It's a great
And I think a lot of the stuff I read now these days too is more grounded in that, where it just is grounded in general. It's just like it's more of a more down to earth approach, because it's becoming more, I don't know. I just feel like people, it's becoming more of a palatable subject these days, because of like different things in the 100%. News and big stories and stuff. But anyway, that's where I found out about this story first, a couple months ago. And then, I just started diving in. So basically this was, like I said, it happened on Friday, September 16th in 1994, about 60 school children between the ages of like 6 and 12, they saw a large silver disc with several smaller discs surrounding it, right outside of their like playground. And they saw it kind of descending down into like a kind of a treed hill area, right outside of their fence of their schoolyard. So more kids started running up and seeing it and yelling and everything and making a big deal of it. They explained it as a like a cigarette-shaped thing with blinking lights, with all different blinking lights, colors surrounding it, like kind of going in and out, all different colors. And you know, one girl said that she didn't hear any like buzzing or whizzing or any kind of like craft noises that you would assume more, but she said she actually heard, which is more creepy, a flute playing noise that, and she said it scared her, which I guess would probably scare me too, because it's not something you'd think you were gonna hear out of something like that. It's like if a dog started like mooing, you'd be like, what the hell?
Jesus.
So anyway, so yeah, that was so one of the creatures apparently like came out of this craft, and kind of a couple of the kids said that it kind of floated toward them or hopped. It wasn't really like walking. It was more like kind of floating. And another being apparently was standing on top of this craft after it landed, kind of like watching everything go on. And the one that was walking toward them on the ground or floating toward them, apparently once they caught, once it caught wind of all the kids there, at first it seemed like it didn't really notice them, and then it did. Turned to them, kind of like made eye contact with some of them, stared for a few moments, and then just went back into the craft and then kind of took off. A few of the kids said they wore like tight black suits with big eyes, kind of like we see like a typical like alien, like real long, elongated eyes, you know. With no nose, just like little holes for their nose. Some of them said they had long black hair. They were kind of walking around a little, observing quickly, and then just like took off. So all the kids ran inside and they were all freaked out. And they told the teachers, and the teachers kind of wrote it off at first. You know, they were just like, you know, they're kids, you know, like they could have seen an animal, whatever, they wrote it off.
Totally.
So this happened on a Friday. So after that, you know, it was the weekend, all the kids went home, and following this, I guess like on Monday, all of the parents of these children started calling in the school, just being like, you know, our kids are completely freaked out. They're all telling kind of the same story. like, what did they see? What was going on? Like, did you see it? The teacher's like, we didn't see anything. They all ran in together. They were all scared. So this caused the school to try to, you know, start bringing in some people from the outside to talk to the kids, interview them, and try to get to the bottom of it a little bit. So the first person they brought in was this woman named Cynthia Hind, who was a local UFO researcher in the area, and also on behalf of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, was the researcher for the whole continent of Africa. So she was like really, really experienced into all these things. Wow. So they called her in, and they wanted her to talk to the kids. And there are videos of her like talking. You can look them up, to the kids in the schoolyard, and they're all kind of like yelling different things that they saw, drawing pictures and all these things. So she does her research and is basically just like, yeah, this is, you know, pretty crazy. And then so she, there's another guy, his name is John Mack, and he was a professor of psychiatry at Harvard and also happened to be a UFO researcher.
Yeah, I definitely believe like I've read him.
Yeah, he wrote this book in the early 90s called Abducted, which is like a huge book. Yeah.
Yes, and that's
so
it. Totally.
Funny enough, this is where things start to get like kind of weird. He was already in Africa at the time researching different things. He was just like interviewing people of different sightings all around the continent, you know, reading different things. He was going to chase down some of these people to talk to some people about different things. So he catches wind. I'm assuming this part is not really known, but through her or just through the grapevine of this story. And so he was about to leave Africa and then was like, nope, I'm going to go and check this out too. So he just happened to be there and then goes to the school to interview these kids. He starts interviewing all the kids separately and have them like draw what they've seen. And he came to the conclusion that like they weren't lying. A lot of their things that they were saying were very consistent with each other. Things about their appearance, the way it took off, the way it came down, all kinds of things, which is also something you can see like on YouTube and stuff. It's really cool. You can watch all the interviews that he does with the kids. And it's funny because the kids, they all seem very scared, you know, and when kids like,
I think,
you know, when you see something, especially as a child, like, I think kids can kind of write it off quickly enough. It was just like whatever, and then they go back to their day. But this is something that bothered them for like days and weeks after. And in these interviews, you can kind of tell they're definitely still shaken up.
Yeah. And you forget that, or I always forget that it was 1994,
yeah,
so it's not that long ago.
Yeah, it's kind of cool too to watch some of the videos because it really isn't that long ago. So it's like, but now a lot of these kids are probably our age, you know, but I'll get to that part. That there's more later. But anyway, so
none
of the kids said, this is another big key of this, to Cynthia Hind and to John Mack, that they had thoughts pop into their head. And apparently the researchers seemed to think that this was through like telepathic ways, but the kids didn't really know of this, so they just said they started thinking of things and they all consistently said that it was based on like warnings to take care of the planet, and that these beings were telepathically telling them to take care of the environment, and which is a common theme in a lot of stories like this of abductions and things where they get messages. People that have gone through these experiences get messages to take care of the planet, like we're killing the planet, take care of it, you know, and things like that. So one of the children said that she was told that the world, telepathically, that the world was going to end, and she never thought of that idea before. It was just something that came into her head. She was like 7 years old. She never thought about like the planet dying, you know, so she had no real knowledge of this before. But then all of a sudden she was told this. One of them said, quote, all the trees will go down and there will be no air and people will be dying. Another one, a fifth grader, his name was Francis, he told John Mack that he was warned about something that's going to happen and that pollution mustn't be. I think it's worthy to note, too, that all the kids have, like, accents because they're in South Africa, so it's kind of really adorable too. When you hear like their warnings of these things, and the way they speak is I don't know, endearing, I guess. But and then another one, an 11-year-old, she said that, quote, "I think they want people to know that we're actually making harm on this world, and we mustn't get too technologized," which is a word she probably came up with on her own. But Jean Mack does all these interviews and concluded with like certainty that the children weren't making it up. He was very used to, he was a psychiatrist, so very used to telling when people are fabricating or just, you know, recalling something, you know, that wasn't really based in truth or wasn't based in hard evidence or anything. But he stayed for a while and interviewed all these kids and decided that it was, you know, that they were being truthful and they said what they saw or saw what they said.
Yeah, that they believed what they said at the very least.
And in fact, that was one of the things he told a lot of the parents were starting to kind of come around a little bit, because they had this Harvard psychiatrist who just happened to be in Africa, by the way. Like, just happened to be there, a UFO investigator who was like a top psychiatrist too at the time, just happened to be in Africa to then reroute his plans to go talk to all these children. To birds with one stone. I'm into this subject and I can talk to them and figure it out, which is pretty crazy in its own way. He kind of convinced the parents to even if they didn't believe the children, that they shouldn't accuse them of lying, because they were obviously very shaken up about this and he didn't want them to like be discredited, to at least be open-minded and hear what they had to say. So with this too came like the teachers began to really believe the kids, and there's interviews too with the teachers that you can find, where the teachers back then are just like, at first we did not believe this at all, but now like we believe it just straight up. Like they just say, hey, we believe this, you know, after seeing all the consistency in the stories and everything. So that's kind of the base of the whole thing. And this is where it gets crazy, because I was reading through this before I got to this part. I was like, this is really interesting. But at the end of it, it really is just a bunch of kids saying they saw something. And, you know, kids can be discredited very easily, unfortunately, I guess. So, you know, basically, Cynthia Hind, who we were talking about before, she comes out and states that, so this happened on September 16th. So September 14th and 15th, 2 days prior, she had also received dozens of reports of sightings throughout the area, seen as far away as Zambia, which is like 650 miles north of Zimbabwe, and Botswana, which is 360 miles southwest of Zimbabwe, of capsule-like fireball in the sky that was flanked by other smaller capsules. So pretty much exactly what the kids saw, a bigger craft with like smaller craft surrounding it. And also a trucker in the area reported on beings that he couldn't figure out what they were on the side of the road, like the night before. So, and then she receives this report about the school. So she's just like going in already like, well, I mean, it's just another report of these things. Like, of course, you know, it all makes sense.
Yeah, she's got to be like, well, of course, it all just like followed this line right
exactly,
here. This is the logical end here.
So all that alone, it's pretty crazy that, you know, you have this story, but the deeper I dug, then finding out about these other events that were happening right before it by Hind, which is really interesting. So there are some follow up interviews that were conducted like in 2014 of some of the kids who are now like, I don't know, in their 30s or whatever. And it's funny because they're all very consistent still, and they're not like, oh, I don't really remember it. They're like adamant. And it's funny to see the interviews of them as little kids and then them as adults just basically saying the same things and really still backing up their stories, you know? And it's really interesting, and you can find some of those interviews too, but it was pretty tough to find, follow-ups. There's only a few, and
true.
you know, a lot of it, I think, has to do with just another common theory of this stuff is that people don't really want to come out with their stories a lot of the times, and even official people in the military or government, because it's like they get ridiculed. You know, they don't want to be like that person that's that has to back these things up.
Dude, 100%. Even before, when you brought up the trucker who saw the, you know, quote unquote strange beings on the side of the road, my first thought was, I'm so glad that I never saw strange beings on the side of the road and then had to A, make a report of it or talk to other people about it, or B, spend the rest of your life framing every experience that you have by the fact that, oh, okay, well, this standing in line at this store to get this thing sucks, but remember when I saw those fucking yeah, like, aliens on the side of the road?
Nobody's going to believe you, but it is a hard thing for people to believe. And one of the things that stood out was one of the children, she, in this interview I found, goes by the name Sarah. It's a fake name. But she was saying that, you know, in quotes, and this kind of struck me at the end, she said, try telling people that you live in permanent fear of these things returning one day. You know, she just still thinks about this. And then she said, try telling them that you can actually sense when they're back in our atmosphere. That's what she says. And,
and what the fuck?
Doesn't say her name. She doesn't say like who she was, but it was, but she, yeah, she doesn't want to, relive this, you know, and it's crazy. Yeah. And yeah, so, cause pass. You know, you think of it on the outside as like, oh, a funny thing that happened. And you, but like, what if you actually saw that, you know, in the way they explained, I mean, that would probably be more terrifying than anything I would assume.
Definitely.
And yeah, I mean, that kind of wraps it up. I mean, there's a lot of, different angles to this, and you can get deeper into the researchers like John Mack and his research from Harvard, and Cynthia Hind, both of whom who have passed away now. Cynthia Hind passed away in 2000, and John Mack passed away in 2004. He was crazily struck by a car in England, like walking down the street.
True, I forgot about that. Yeah,
there's some things that people have mystery that. Surrounding that. He dedicated his whole life to this topic, and he was important to mention too, like shunned by Harvard, like for being on this subject. He only had a few people around him at the university that were on his side with this. A lot of people wanted to discredit him, and a lot of people said he was losing his mind getting into this stuff. And I mean, you watch these interviews that he does, especially with these children, and he clearly is not a person whose mind is lost. I mean, he's a very, like, you know, he's a very well-spoken, down-to-earth guy, and the way he interacts with the children too, I definitely suggest people look up the interviews, because it's just really cool. It's like, how would you talk to a children who has seen this? You know, how would you, I don't know that I'd be able to ask the right questions. And I mean, obviously he's a professional at this, so he knew. But it's all very crazy, because you have two aspects. You have two, like, the children's accounts, which are children's accounts, and they can be kind of spooky when you hear them talk about these things. But then you have these researchers' accounts who were talking about instances that that back this up, that happened days prior to this even happening. Yeah.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, that's such a big deal, that corroboration, you know? It's funny. I don't know if I have the nomenclature right, or not even the nomenclature, the right lingo down for the UFO researcher community kind of shit. But events like this, I believe they call them like experiencer events, like where you have some kind of psychic connection or experience, like the close encounters of the third or fourth kind. I forget which one it is, where you actually see or talk to, you know, beings or consciousnesses or whatever the fuck it is. And at first, I was real into it. When I was first, like, very young, early teenager, researching this kind of stuff and learning about it and just being generally interested in it. And then I pushed it away really hard, because I was like, no, you can't rely on anything anecdotal. It has to be, there has to be radar corroboration or government documents or, like, video footage, like any of those things. And now that I've gotten older, it's making a full circle back again. I'm starting to realize that, yeah, these, you know, these lived experiences of these people do hold some interesting facets, especially when they're corroborated separately, when they, you know, like recently the episode of the Berkshire UFO case that came out on the new Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix, where the people had experienced the same things but didn't tell each other till decades later and then realized that they had had the same thing. Like, that kind of stuff does not necessarily have to be thrown away for it. But, yeah, that's such a good story. I really need to watch those YouTube videos of the kids.
And apparently there is, like, a documentary that has been being made for the last couple of years that I also found in digging around. I think it's in some sort of halted state right now. I don't really know, like, what's going on with it. But, yeah, apparently there will be, there has been anyway, a documentary. And I did get some of the information from interviews of some of the more recent interviews of the children from YouTube areas that were, I think, connected to this possible documentary. So, you know, credit to them too.
Nice. I'm definitely going to put links to some of that shit in the show notes. So if you go to the website, it'll just, I'll put like whatever links to YouTube or just some like an instruction of how to Google or some shit like that. But hell yeah. All right. So I'm gonna tell my story. It is about Japan Airlines JAL-1628, which was an incident that happened in 1986. I picked this one for a couple reasons. One is one of the earliest ones I can remember learning about, maybe seeing it on like the Discovery Channel or some shit like that. But 1986, the year we were both born. You know, you got to rock that. It's also extremely well documented. It involved a shit ton of people. It's got testimony by all three crew members, civilian air traffic control, military radar, civilian radar, the weather radar on the plane, and then all this kind of wild-ass shit that happened with the FAA afterwards. It is alleged to be one of, if not the longest, civilian radar tracking of a UFO incident because they had this like weather radar node in the front of the plane in the nose, and they used it to track this thing for a sequence of time. Also, there's this guy, John Callahan, who was a whistleblower from the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. I think he was third in line to the head of the FAA. He was the head of the Accidents and Investigations Division, but he's got this super thick Boston, New England kind of accent, and he's like really funny and just one of those, like, I don't know, no-nonsense people from like a detective in a movie that uncovers the corrupt cops.
Like a Mark Wahlberg.
I love it so much.
Yeah.
He's very much like a Mark Wahlberg. He's fucking funny. So I couldn't figure out whether or not I can actually play any of his interview shit on here because I don't know if it'll get pulled or if it'll be copyright infringement or whatever, but if I figure it out by this end of this week, then I'm going to stick some. I'll probably stick it in like right here. And also, one of the other reasons I chose this was because, Joe, remember how cool
it
was when we went to Japan?
Yeah, it seems like a different life at this point. Yeah, that was probably the coolest place I feel like I've been, for sure.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I got to say that when we were flying, so we flew similar airspace to where this incident happened over Alaska. And at one point I went to the back of the plane and looked out the window, and you could just, as far as the eye can see, it was just snow-capped, like rigid, rough-angled mountains. And it was the most surreal, otherworldly thing I've ever seen this far in life.
Yeah.
Looking out the window, I was like, holy shit. And I just couldn't stop thinking about this incident and what that must have been like to be these guys. So here we go. We had the JAL 1628, the JAL, our jail pals. I could never remember the flight number for some reason, so now it's 28 days later and when you're driving. So that's how I remember it, 1628. The whole thing takes place just under an hour, about 50 minutes. We got a Japan Airlines 747. It's a cargo plane, no passengers, just three crew members, flying from Paris to Reykjavik, the millennial vacation destination of the world, and then up and over near the North Pole, Arctic, to Fairbanks, Alaska, and then again onto Tokyo. So one hilarious kind of note to me is that all the cargo was just full of wine from France, a Beaujolais wine. So that's pretty kind of funny. It gets brought up a lot when people are retelling the story because they make jokes about them like dipping in the stash of the wine in the back of the plane, which I don't know. I've been pretty fucked up before, including on Beaujolais. And I don't think I would see an aircraft carrier size structure and
or be in charge of
that while
wanting
it's being
to
on radar
fly a huge cargo plane. You'd be like, I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm good on that.
Exactly. Maybe the aliens were just like, damn, they were debating whether or not they were going to jack all the Beaujolais from the plane. So at this point, when this all goes down, they already landed in Iceland and they're on their way to Anchorage. They get a communication from Anchorage Air Traffic Control asking them to turn away from this one fort that's up there. So they turn away from the fort, and they change their direction a little bit. And then the captain, his name is Captain Kenju Terauchi. Believe I'm saying that right. It was pronounced a couple different ways, but that's what they pronounced it on the documentaries. It's a little bit after 5 p.m. Alaska time. He's a former fighter pilot with over 10,000 hours in the sky. He gets he sees two objects to the left, about 2,000 feet below him, like 10 o'clock. They appear in front of him. So they're gone. He sees them. He's like, what the fuck? This must be two military planes. We're near a fort. Whatever. So then the first officer radios the Anchorage Air Traffic Control Center to ask if they have any vehicles or they have any planes traffic near them, because at that point the two objects appeared in front of the plane about 500 to 1,000 feet away, slightly above them. The captain said in a later on an FAA report that they were about the size of Boeing 707s, so I guess a little bit smaller than his plane, and that the lights actually emitted heat because he felt it on his face in the cabin. So like whatever the lights on the craft that were in front of them, he like felt it. I believe he used the word afterburner to describe them when he was given the report. But yeah, he's just kind of, you know, blasted heat in there, like, oh shit. So
Which isn't a common thing in a lot of reports to like feel something. You know, it's very yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, you don't really see that. I guess it kind of makes sense because you're above Alaska. Mm-hmm. It's freezing cold. It was nighttime, or it was like dark, ish. Getting there dark. It was 5 p.m. Alaska time. So like that heat, you know, might be more. If the thing was only 500 feet away, it makes sense. You know, it's crazy, but you definitely don't. See that. It's not like, you know, Saturn doesn't blast you with heat when you mistake it for with ice crystals.
I mean, even the sun, if you're on a plane, like, you're not like, you know, you're not really like getting like, you might feel warmer if the sun's on you, but you're not getting blasted with like an oven, you know.
true. So, yeah, 15 minutes after the first sighting, now they moved in front of the plane. The first officer radios air traffic control and asks if they have any aircraft or military aircraft in the area. Alaska Air Traffic Control, Anchorage ATC is like, hey, can you repeat that? What? And JAL asks again. ATC says, no, we don't have anything. And JAL says, well, we see two planes in front of us. So then they go back and forth for a little bit. And Anchorage Air Traffic Control tries to get them to see what kind of planes they are. They asked if, like, can you tell? Can you see anything on the tails? And they asked about the lights that they were emitting. So Captain Trachi says they are white and yellow, I think. Which, a side note, I think it's interesting because he couldn't really tell what the color was. And I don't want to read too far into it. But, you know, if you're experiencing something that you don't quite understand or have no frame of reference for, you're going to pull from your worldview. So you're just going to, like, guess maybe it's yellow. Maybe it's not a regular type of bulbed electric light emission situation that we are used to seeing, you know, in our light spectrum, whatever. But so now it's 5:23. Only a few minutes have gone by since the beginning of this thing. So they saw it first at like 5:10. So then, poof, the objects shoot below the horizon, shoot out of sight. So they keep going. Then he sees a little bit of light where they first appeared to the left. And air traffic control says they don't have anything on the radar. But then JAL points their onboard digital weather radar system, sets it so that it could be within like 20 or 25 miles. That's like how far out it's going to check. And then 7 or 8 miles away, they get it. They hit it on the radar. It's a big green blip. They have the tapes for it. They have all the instrumentation set for it. And then it gets intense. So the captain radios in and says something to the effect of, it's really big. It's very big. So he sounds nervous. He's kind of freaking out. You can listen to the tapes. They have them up on YouTube and shit. He later says it was the size of two aircraft carriers. And for reference, an aircraft carrier they're huge. The largest plane to ever fly besides the Spruce Goose, the H-4, is the Antonov, which is wingspan is 84 meters, and one Nimitz-class carrier is four times that width. And he said he was the size of two of them. So that's like eight times the size of the biggest plane that has flown. Yeah, I think that if I looked out the window and saw that over those mountains, I would just die. It's like the dream where you ever have a dream where you're like in a car and the car is either way too small or way too big for the type of like dysmorphia around you and your settings in your dream. I think I would just
totally
happen and I would just
think
out.
About, you know, it's one thing for a pilot to see something and be like, wow, that's big, but I mean, I don't even think you need to be a pilot with knowledge of different aircraft sizes to to just see something like that and know that something's not right. You know, like that's abnormal. That can't even be a plane, because even if I don't even know how big military planes are, you know, you're still going to be like freaked out.
Totally. Yeah. Later on in the FAA report, he said that it looked like a shelled walnut shape, and it was the size of two aircraft carriers, and it was glowing. And there, the two other things were like flipping around it and shit. So yeah, that's horrifying. So they didn't die like I would have, and they didn't really freak out. They radioed air traffic control and asked to deviate from the object, like it could change course, get away from this thing. So they let them do it. They could go like 240 degree heading change, and it stays with them. So then the air traffic control in Anchorage said, I'm just going to call them ATC from now. ATC has them do a full 360 degree turn to the right. So they do a giant loop-de-loop to see if this thing follows them or not. After this, the object disappeared, and JAL said they can't see it with their eyes, and they didn't have it on the radar. So this is where it gets even a little bit crazier, because they're flying over Elmendorf Air Force Base, and they're kind of their radar operator, air traffic control people are kind of tagged in at this point. And they actually do have the object still on the radar. So they contact ATC to tell them that the object is indeed still following JAL 1628. So ATC says, "Hey, 1628 military radar advises they are picking up intermittent primary target behind you in trail, I say again." So they're reaching out to JAL to be like, no, the military radar still has this thing following you. So then there's an interesting exchange between ATC and the Air Force Base, where they're deciding whether or not they're going to scramble jets on account of how nervous the JAL flight is. And then they ask the JAL Captain Taraci, who, you know, was a fighter pilot, had 10,000 hours of flight time at this point, if he wanted the jets to scramble to intervene. And he said no.
It's a cool head.
Yeah, right. It's definitely a cool head. People say that they like ascribe reason as to why he did it. He didn't say why that I could find, but they say it's because of his knowledge of a time where like a couple decades earlier, where a military plane was shot down, or maybe the 1976 Tehran incident. But I couldn't find anything that corroborated that, so I shouldn't even have brought it up, because now it's just going to be in their minds. So now the ATC, we're approaching like 45, 50 minutes here. ATC gets United 69, a flight, a big plane on a similar in the airspace, to go and fly with an eyesight of JAL 1628, and they say that they don't see anything. So they're like, can you see a big object behind it? And they're like, nah. And at this point, it's just gone. There's no more incidences, and JAL lands in Anchorage about an hour after everything started, and that's that. So that was wild enough, and that'd be crazy enough to just have all those tapes and all of that information. But it gets a little bit fucking crazier. To our favorite place, a wild bureaucratic trash fire. So two characters that I love in this, both, you know, the no nonsense, stand by your principle kind of people. Captain Taraci, he gets stuck at a desk job for many, many years after this. After talking to the press, I think it was the Kyoto newspaper, about the experience, as well as to American news outlets. And then, so that sucks. But he eventually was reinstated many years later. But then John Callahan, this guy's great. John Callahan, he's this Boston-sounding guy. He's the FAA division chief of the Accidents and Investigations Branch in Washington, D.C. So like a week after all this goes down, he gets a call. And I'm just going to start to paraphrase some of his testimony from a transcript at the National Press Club UFO conference in D.C., which I believe was in the summer of 2001. So in early January of 1987, I received a call from the Air Traffic Quality Control Branch in FAA's Alaskan regional office, requesting guidance on what to tell the media personnel who were overflowing their office. The media was requesting information about the UFO that chased the Japanese 747 across the Alaskan sky for some 3 minutes at flight levels between 30,000 feet, 35,000 feet on November 7, 1986. Somehow the word had got out that this had happened, and all the media were chasing after them. So he asked the guy, he's like, what UFO? When did this take place? Why wasn't the Washington headquarters informed? And the guy said, hey, man, who believes in UFOs? I just need to know what to tell the media to get them out of here. So he tells him, he says, all right, tell them it's under investigation, then collect all the data, the voice tapes, the data disk for both the facility and the military. Send all that shit overnight to the FAA Tech Center, which, hilariously enough, is in Atlantic City, New Jersey. I don't know why the FAA Tech Center is in Atlantic City. That's kind of hilarious. I don't know what kind of backdoor congressional pork trade-off happened to put that there.
I don't associate official buildings.
That's where it is.
anywhere in that area.
No,
no offense to Atlantic City, but I'm sure anybody that I'm sure anybody
love, I love Atlantic City, but
agree.
Yeah, you know why. So after receiving the data from Alaska, almost 2 months later, he briefed his boss, Harvey Schaefer, and the FAA administrator, Admiral Engen. And Schaefer and I went to the FAA Tech Center to observe the playback. So it gets a little technical here. I'm just going to say what he said because it just, you know, it'll make sense. The FAA had developed a program capable of recreating the traffic on the controller's scope or plain view display. I instructed the FAA specialist to synchronize the voice tapes with the radar data so we could hear everything the controller and pilot said while being able to see what they saw on their scopes. I videotaped the radar display. Later that day, I requested that the FAA automation specialists plot the radar targets along the route of flight and explain what each target was doing. I videotaped that resulting chart. The printout and radar playback displayed primary targets in the vicinity of the 747. Those target returns were displayed about the same time and place as the pilot advised viewing the UFO. Both the radar and manual controller observed the primary target. So basically they say that the radar, the manual controller part of it, the pilot's conversations with the ATC and the military radar were all plotted on like a timeline. It seems like a computer would be able to do this very easily right now, and then it would just have happened within, you know, live, but apparently he had to go and kind of do all this. And then it gets real crazy. So he's got this video that he makes that shows all of these overlapping points of data coinciding with each other and seems to show that, yes, radar did hit at this moment of this thing when he said he saw it at this spot. So he takes the video, brings it back to the FAA headquarters, gives it to Administrator Engen in a quick briefing, and shows him the video. So that guy sets up a briefing with President Reagan's scientific staff and told John his function was to give them a dog and pony show and hand this event off to them. So he's like, give him a, yeah, this guy's pretty funny. And I'll quote him, quote unquote, since the FAA does not deal with UFOs. That's what his administrator told him. So he says, I brought along a copy of the video and all the data printouts available at the time. One of the scientists asked a number of questions, such as what is the range of the radar, what is the frequency of the radar, what is the bandwidth, what is the formula for the height equipment, etc. He's impressed with the response from the FAA experts that were with him that were letting these guys know. But then at the end, and this is, you know, anecdotal, but at the end, one of the three people from the CIA said, this event never happened. We were never here. We're confiscating all this data, and you are all sworn to secrecy. He asked him, what do you think it was? He asked the CIA guy, and the CIA guy said, a UFO, and now they have over 30 minutes of radar to go over. Well, let's get a Twix out and advise the American public that we were visited by a UFO. That's what they suggested. And he said, no way. If we were to tell the American public there are UFOs, they would panic. Sometime after the briefing, the detailed FAA report, which included extensive interviews with the pilot and crew, the chart prepared at the tech center, and the facility voice tapes arrived at his office and were placed in a small table waiting for the CIA to request more data. The material stayed there until he retired 2 years later. They never came and got it, and he actually kept it ever since. So that's how we have a lot of this information. Is it was given to him to pass on to the CIA, and he just, or whomever was in charge of investigating this, and he just kept it. So that's where we're at with it
that's
today.
That's crazy.
Yeah, the end gets pretty nuts. It's hard, you know, when somebody says that some guy at the CIA was like, this never happened, you're all sworn to secrecy. It's like, really?
Yeah.
You think that's how the government would work? But I don't know, man. Truth is often stranger than fiction, and this guy was the head of that department of the FAA. So, like,
yeah,
why,
I guess, you know, looking into a lot of these things, too, these kinds of, you know, sightings and things and reports, like, what always strikes me is that these bureaucratic groups and you know, they're just filled with people. Like we look at them as these very I don't know, I sometimes do anyway, just these foggy groups that you can't really, you know, put human qualities to, I suppose. But really they're just, if they have a job and their job is to just like make this sound like silly or whatever, they're just gonna say a thing that a guy would say. I don't know, I guess I'm just trying to say they're just humans, you know.
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, think about how the bureaucrats always fucking work. Anytime you're trying to, we have to do so many things like internationally with certain types of paperwork and stuff, and someone's always trying to pass it off to somebody else. And I understand it's not the best example, but that's what we have to deal with in our life. And it makes total sense earlier where he says that the guy who's in charge of the FAA was like, listen, take this shit over here to the president's scientific advisory. Give him a dog and pony show and then pass it off because we don't know what this is. We don't deal with it. And then, you know, how many times does that happen until they just drop the hot potato or pass the buck or whatever, you know? Like, that's a, it seems like a lot of the things that are being hidden from us regarding these events are along those lines. There's that guy, Dr. John B. Alexander, wrote that book. He's an old Air Force colonel, I believe, and his whole thing was like, it's incompetence more so than it is like an orchestrated group of people hiding it intentionally.
There's two big,
makes sense to me,
you know, schools of thought, I guess you could say. And one is that there's this shadow group that's hiding all this, and it's, you know, run by like a few head people, and they kind of dictate what happens with all this information or all these kinds of things, or even control it in some way. And then there's this other, like you said, with John B. Alexander, where his theory is more along the lines of, no, if you really knew how the government worked and really, really the inner workings, it would be nearly impossible for that to even be the case. You know, and you can take that with whatever. I mean, he was a guy that worked within different areas of the government for like years. So maybe he would know, or who knows, but those are the two big things where it's either, like you said, incompetence and just not having an official area to actually report these things, or just a very small group controlling all of it. So it kind of...
Totally.
Yeah,
it could
be
a mixture of them all. Who knows?
You know, most likely it's like a third option that we don't even know, you know, so who knows?
Yeah. Totally. Love that. But yeah, that was fun, man. And I'll definitely put some links to some of the shit from this. And there's a couple cool documentaries about this. There's one book that I found. I couldn't find any, like, you know, well, widespread books I can order now about this incident. But there's one or two written by somebody that seemed cool. Oh, and this one actually gets even crazier. I didn't even want to dive into it because it's so much for, you know, that it's palatable. And that is that two more instances happened a month or two later, one involving the military, where they referenced this incident. So there was some interaction that happened with some fighter pilots over, I believe, this Air Force base or one that was close, also in the vicinity, where they had run into it. And they, during the conversation with the air traffic controller, they referenced this event. And they're like, yeah, when you get back, we want you to talk to this head of this guy. And then they just stopped talking about it.
Crazy, too. Yeah, it's funny when you start pulling at the strings of this stuff, like what happens. Because, like I said, the first time I heard about this story was in that book by Richard Dolan, but it was really only... two pages of the sort, because it was just a section of the book where it was just a bunch of different some of the more credible sightings and things that have happened. And it was, you know, two pages on this thing, and I was like, there's got to be more to this. I mean, this sounds pretty crazy. And so it's cool digging into it.
Oh, I fucking love it, man. I'm down to it again anytime that you want to. And it's crazy to realize how many of these thing, quote unquote, things there are. Recently, I was doing an interview with somebody, and he was cool, super cool guy, and he was like, mentioned UFOs and stuff. I was like, so do you believe in that stuff? And I was like, what a weighted and non, you know, how do you answer that? Like, you can't. Do you believe that all UFOs are alien spacecraft? Do you believe that any are alien spacecraft? There's so much stigma and weird shit around it that parsing through it is just so fucking impossible, especially with the way that people bring their passions to it. But just long story short, the main thing that you realize when you first start looking into this stuff is that the sheer number of cases involving, you know, sane, sober people and instrumentation is there's so many thousands of them that the onus of responsibility to prove that the phenomenon doesn't exist almost seems to apply to people that would, quote-unquote, consider themselves a skeptic in that regard. It's like, no, there's so much evidence that you'd have to prove otherwise.
Yeah, there was an interview that I came across while I was, you know, researching this, and it was with, I don't know, it was like YouTube, so it just started playing things. I'm not going to pretend I remember what the exact thing was from or when it was from or where, but it was an interview with a woman who was talking about how she came out of her house and her two sons were like laying on the ground in fear because they saw this like craft, and she was like, there's nothing there. And then she like looks up, and sure enough, there's this crazy huge thing. And this is like such a common theme. She's just, the whole time she's trying to be like, and I'm not crazy. Like I never thought about this stuff before. I never believed it, you know, and to have somebody like really, try to push that point tells me two things. It's one, that, it can just happen to anybody, you know, and these things can just kind of happen. And two, it's just that, you know, you're scared because of your like reputation as just a sane human being is going to be. So as soon as that kind of stigma gets erased, I think it could be even, I think even more stuff will come out that people have just been, you know, hiding for or holding on to for years. And thankfully, you and I have never really been,
for sure,
really never gave a shit to talk about this stuff. I don't know. I'm sure there's people
not
when
even
we
once.
Like get into it on tour, you know, we're talking backstage, and you know, you could tell people could really care less. They're just like, I don't know, what the hell are they talking about?
Oh yeah.
But I think that's,
or it's always hilarious to find somebody who's fervently opposed, you know, somebody who's like really into like scientific materialism, and they're just like, well, you'd be like, you could ask them the question. It's such a weird cognitive dissonance, and I'm totally doing a straw man thing where I'm like setting up this type of person and knocking them down. But they'll be like, do you believe that the human are the only conscious beings in the material universe anywhere? And they're going to be like, well, that'd be silly. No, of course not. I'm like, well, do you believe that they had visited here, or that there may be some type of way that we've interacted as we've evolved, or the way that you know, what life is? And then they're just gonna be, they get angry and will be like, no, that's absurd.
Yeah.
And it's like, so why? There's so much evidence to suggest otherwise. And I think that sometimes we rely on like these institutions to bring the information to us, or even things like the scientific method or the scientific community with its current economic motivations based off of, you know, the different institutions that they're beholden to. Not saying that it's inherently a bad thing. It's absurd. It's brought us so many beautiful things. But just to like the idea that everything is be able to be explained away is just, I don't know, just it's a bizarre cognitive dissonance to me, because you start to look at the actual events and you stop and you're like, oh. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so much of, without getting too deep, but so much of the media's angle is just to, like mainstream media, is just to gather up information and present it in a digestible way for a mass number of people. And that's great. Yeah, which is great. I mean, and
which
that's great in most cases, because there is a lot of information. We rely on serious and credible journalists to like figure these things out and pack them in a nice neat thing and give it to us, and we scroll through it constantly on our phones all day, and I'm very thankful for that.
And we get angry when they when we disagree with them, and we think they or we get angry when they don't do a good enough job. And we don't want to pay them.
But I mean, and that's awesome, but there's so much more than these digestible nuggets that we get fed all day through apps or news or, you know, social media, that like things like this that we discussed today. It reminded me how much I love like actually, you know, researching these things and looking into them. And I mean, I'm no researcher. I probably mumbled halfway through most of that shit, but I just think that, you know, nobody else is going to give you this story. So, you know, it's like, I don't know, you can trace it back to music. Like nobody was telling it, like we had to find the bands we wanted to listen to, and you have to find the stories you want to hear sometimes too, you know, and they're not always going to be the ones that are pushed out to you.
Damn, that's a really good point. Hell yeah. Nice. I think we wrap it up with that. Hell yeah, man. Well, thank you so very much for coming on. I can't wait to watch those videos of the Zimbabwe kids, especially any follow-ups. That's got to be crazy, dude. Because, I mean, they had to be our age. If it was 1994, we would have
been in the schools,
eight,
I think I mentioned they ranged from 6 to 12 at the time it happened. So, yeah, they're all right around our age. Yeah, it's really cool.
So they're all our age
we'll
right
throw
now.
Some links
that's
up.
Crazy.
This is fun.
Nice. Oh, I also got to give a shout-out to a YouTube channel that was super helpful when I was researching the JAL event. It is called The Flight. Oh, shit.
Nice.
The Flight Channel. Got it. Sorry, I wrote it down. I want to make sure I get it. It's all one word, switched together, The Flight Channel. Somebody takes famous and infamous. You probably wouldn't want to watch this if you. It's a lot of them if you're not a big fan of flying. But they use like super hyper realistic flight simulator software, and then they plug in the data points from whatever they're going over, and then they visualize the event. So I saw one that was this particular one, the JAL Flight 1628, was really cool. Wow. It was from the inside of the flight simulator, and you were able to, they added the objects into where it was, and it made it a palatable timeline without all the like flashy dramatizations that you'd find on some of the old UFO shows and the current UFO shows. And they had all kinds of ones. They had ones where, like, I watched one this morning of a guy who the pilot like had a heart attack, and then one of the passengers who had some like a little bit of flight training had to land the plane. So they have the actual audio from the air traffic control like going back and forth to him, and they're showing what the plane was doing and when it was doing it. It was cool. And they did also the MH370. Remember that plane that disappeared? Malaysian Airlines. I think it was MH370. What happened like right before we got, or while we were in Australia, and it crashed like west of Australia. It was super weird. But they go over that entire story and they plot all the plot points out, or data points out on that. It's super fascinating. I'm rambling about the flight channel, but it was really cool. And I'm
for anybody that doesn't know, we probably touched on this, I think, on an episode that I was on earlier. But yeah, I don't like flying necessarily, and I've been a lot better with it. But right now is like a perfect time for me to get into stuff because I'm not flying anywhere anytime soon. So I'm like, yeah, sure, show me all those fucking people crashing up. I don't care, whatever. Like, I'm not flying anywhere anytime soon.
Oh yeah, dude.
But yeah.
I actually learned the biggest aviation disaster ever actually happened on the runway, in the Canary Islands. Yeah, it's weird. Two pilots were like big dick at each other, basically. You know, no offense to their dead relatives. I don't think any of them are, or their alive relatives. I doubt any of them are listening to this. But like, they were just like kind of being macho. One of the pilots fucking took off while one of them wasn't off the ramp yet. Wow. And just smashed into it. Yeah, killed like 600 people.
That's terrifying.
Crazy.
I think the biggest airline disaster was the plane that crashed on the island on the way to Australia. And then they all experienced their own version of heaven or hell while on the island. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, J.J. Abrams directed it,
flight that happened. So it was a true story. He came back and wrote that.
Oh, it was a true story. That was where all I remember about that show was that...
Yeah, we did.
You and Greg liked it a lot.
Yeah.
And I didn't like it, but the guy from Lord of the Rings was on it, and he one of the Hobbits.
I forget the name of his band. Yeah. He was one of the best. Charlie, I think.
Yeah, he's Charlie. Yeah, Charlie, and he found the heroin and the ceramic
cat.
So many memories of walking in and be like, "Hey, can you guys explain what's going on?" And everyone being like, "No, it's too deep."
Where do
and
I
they
start?
Just were winging it the whole fucking time.
Nice.
Yeah. Swanson?
Sawyer.
Maybe one of the guys' name was Swanson? Swanson. I don't know. It wasn't. Sawyer.
Complicated character. Complicated.
But hell yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. But Joe, thank you so much for coming on. We got to do this again anytime you want to. I'm going to try to start putting an episode out every week to stay like, you know, fun and accountable, and we can do anything. It'll be fun.
See ya.
But yeah, bye-bye. All right. Thanks so much for joining me for the first ever episode of Friday Files. I'm really excited to keep this thing rolling. Shoot me an email, tom@futurefriday.net, about literally anything. Also, go to Instagram and check out Little Fern Workshop. Again, that is Eric and George's new company. Vintage, restored, and handcrafted items out of South Philly. You can search #fernsinstock for available items, or if you're having trouble finding them. They got some really cool shit. I can't recommend it enough. Eric and George do such a great fucking job, not only finding and curating the stuff, but also restoring it. It looks amazing. And that's all for this week. See you next week.
Hey everyone, this is Tuck from Fit for a King, an off-road minivan. Every week I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.